Jessie slid her gun into her holster, grabbed her phone, and called for help.
"Jason is still out there," Lacey said, pointing toward the field. "We were buried underground."
"How did you get out?"
"Through a vent. I'm not sure how long Jason will be able to survive. That man dropped a hose into the vent and turned it on full blast. It won't be long before..."
Jessie ran out the back door before Lacey could finish. 50. Colin and Wren stood on the welcome mat in front of Peyton White's home. Colin rang the bell. A dog barked. It sounded as if a dozen kids were running around inside. A woman, most likely Peyton's wife, opened the door.
"Hello," Colin said. "I am Detective Grayson, and this is Detective Howe. Are you Mrs. White?"
She nodded.
"We have a search warrant to check your property."
Wren handed her the paper in his hand.
"Why?"
She ran a hand through her hair.
"What's going on?"
She skimmed over the warrant, then called out for Peyton. When he came to the door, he looked from Colin to the paper in his wife's hand, snatched it from her, and read it over.
"This is nuts. What are you hoping to find?" "We'll need you to open the garage door," Wren told him.
Peyton glared.
"You need to leave."
"It won't take long,"
Colin promised.
"We just need to take a quick look around your backyard and then do a thorough search of the garage."
"Come inside and let's get this over with," his wife said. "My husband has nothing to hide."
"Thank you,"
Colin said. He looked at Wren.
"I'll search the backyard, you start in the garage."
Wren nodded. Peyton hadn't moved. His wife nudged him with a hand to his arm.
"Open the garage, Peyton. It's going to be all right. Please, I want these men to do what they need to do and leave as soon as possible."
"This is madness,"
Peyton growled. Colin left Wren to deal with Peyton and followed Mrs. White to the French doors leading to the backyard. She opened the doors wide and said,
"What exactly are you looking for?"
One small child ran up to her side and clutched the hem of her blouse.
"I'm sorry, I can't say."
He stepped outside. The back fence was half covered with nicely trimmed shrubs. He walked over to the pergola that lent shade to a wood deck and furniture. There were a couple of seating areas for reading or enjoying the day. He looked around, his gaze settling on a plant with white blooms. As he stepped off the deck, he reached into his pocket and pulled out a pair of disposable gloves and slipped them on. He walked across a patch of grass to the plant that was growing from a large terracotta pot. He pulled out a paper bag. Inside were smaller plastic bags. He used one to collect pieces of the foliage. He was almost finished when he heard shouting coming from inside the house. He pulled off the gloves and tucked everything inside the zippered pocket in his coat. Colin rushed through the French doors. The commotion was coming from the garage. He followed the sound, running through the kitchen and laundry room. By the time he was inside the garage, Wren had Peyton White pinned face down to the cement floor next to the family car.
"He fucking hit me,"
Wren said when Colin appeared.
Colin exhaled. One of Wren's knees was jammed into the middle of Peyton's back.
"What's going on?"
Colin asked.
"What are you hiding, Mr. White?"
"God damn it,"
the man answered, his voice muffled until Colin gestured for Wren to lighten up.
"I'm not hiding anything,"
Peyton said.
"Then why did you hit Detective Howe?"
"Because he was asking for it. Pushing my buttons. Getting in my face."
Colin looked at Wren, who lifted his shoulders.
"I had nothing to do with Roger Willis hanging himself,"
Peyton said.
"I don't know why you two are here. You're scaring my wife and kids and making the neighbors nervous. I didn't do whatever the hell you think I did."
"Listen,"
Colin told him.
"If Detective Howe decides that it's safe to let you go, you're going to have to stand to the side and let us do our jobs."
Silence.
"If you don't cooperate, we're going to have to stick you in the back of the cruiser and take you to the station."
"This is bullshit,"
Peyton spat out. Colin exhaled.
"What's it going to be?"
"Let me up,"
Peyton finally said.
"I'm not going to hurt anyone."
Wren looked at Colin and he nodded. Half of Peyton's face was marked with angry red lines after being pressed against the hard cement floor. Peyton straightened his shirt as he found an area near the corner of the garage, where he could stare at Wren. His arms were folded tightly across his chest. The twisted mouth and sour expression said it all. He wanted to punch something. When they left the house an hour later, Colin and Wren walked away with two items: the white bloom from the backyard, and a piece of rope that looked similar to the rope used in the hanging of Roger Willis.
"So what do you think?"
Wren asked as they crossed the road.
"I think you need to put some ice on that shiner."
"Yeah,"
Wren said.
"If I thought he was guilty, I would be thinking about pressing charges about now."
"What makes you think he's innocent?"
"Forget it, it's nothing."
"Just say it,"
Colin urged.
"I won't judge."
Wren stopped at his car. Colin waited.
"Research shows that our accuracy of detecting a lie is about 53%, which means you might as well toss a coin. But the real key is to watch a person's reactions to a question rather than just listen."
"So if I tell you I hate your outfit,"
Colin said,
"am I lying or telling the truth?"
Wren smiled.
"You never shifted from your baseline. Nothing changed in eye movement, etc. Definitely the truth."
Colin chuckled.
"Okay, so Peyton White stuck to his baseline?"
Wren nodded.
"I started asking him questions about his friendship with Roger Willis. I pushed and prodded and stepped over the line. If he'd been lying, I would have seen some physical shifts that would have clued me into his discomfort. Instead, he threw a punch."
"Intuition and creative skills like yours can be helpful in detective work,"
Colin said.
"But science and evidence are crucial."
"Noted,"
Wren said as he opened the door and climbed in behind the wheel. When Colin headed for his own car, Wren asked,
"Where are you off to?"
"I'm going to drop what we found off at the lab so forensics can examine it. How about you?"
"I'm heading back to the spot near the river where we found Willis. I want to take a look around, see if we missed anything."
"Okay,"
Colin said with a nod.
"We'll touch base later."
The rookie had already driven off by the time Colin slid into the front seat of his car. A movement caught his attention. He looked back at Peyton's house. Somebody was peeking through the curtain covering the front window. A kid? A nervous wife? An angry man? Homicide investigations made people leery. There were times when Colin thought everyone looked guilty, even the dog. But the thing he'd learned over the years was never to rush an investigation. As he drove off, he thought of Jesse. The same rules often applied to their relationship. Don't rush things. Stay focused. And communication was key to success. 51.
"Who are you?"
Mrs. Cash shouted at Zee when Zee poked her head out of her hiding place inside the guest room closet.
"You're the woman I met at the casino,"
Ellis Cash said, pointing a gun at her. Zee nodded. Now that he recognized her, she hoped maybe he would put the gun away.
"Keep your hands up where I can see them,"
he said, waving the gun around. Zee thought about trying to wrestle the firearm from the old man.
"Don't you dare. Do it. Do it."
"Not now," Zee pleaded with the voices. She needed to keep her wits about her if she wanted to get through this in one piece.
"Who are you talking to?"
Ellis asked.
"Nobody."
He leaned forward and peeked inside the closet and saw no one but Zee. That was Zee's chance to grab the gun, but she didn't. A part of her didn't think Ellis had it in him to shoot her dead. He was old. In his case, life was really short.
"What are we going to do?"
the woman asked her husband, wringing her hands.
"Calm down, Dorothy. Just give me a minute to think."
"Your daughter is still alive, isn't she?" Zee asked. Frances gasped. Dorothy gasped, too.
"Are you trying to get yourself killed?"
Lucy wanted to know.
"I told you in the casino she was murdered,"
Ellis said, the menacing look on his face making her a little nervous. Zee shook her head.
"When you won that jackpot, I said your kids are going to be getting a lot of money, and you said she's not getting any of this."
Dorothy groaned, clearly unhappy with her husband.
What about the two of them talking to their daughter on the phone? Francis reminded Z.
That's right, Z thought. She'd almost forgotten.
I just heard you both talking to Arlene on the phone. She lives in New England and she has kids. Why didn't you ever tell Penny that her mother was alive?
Because Penny's father would have gone after her,
Ellis said angrily.
He would have killed Arlene. He's a violent man.
That's not true. He's never hurt a flea, never been in a fistfight, and he never hit his wife. I'm an investigator, Z stated proudly, and I'm good at it.
Lucy groaned. Her ego is the size of Mount Everest.
Yeah, well, Francis said. Some things never change. She's definitely going to get herself shot.
Z ignored the voices.
There was never even one report filed against Nathaniel, either by neighbors or by your daughter. The worst thing Nathaniel Snyder did was love Arlene too much. He wanted her to be happy.
Dorothy looked at Ellis.
You saw bruises. Isn't that right? When I came back from seeing my sister in New York, you said Arlene had a black eye and that he'd hit her, and that wasn't the first time. He beat her on more than one occasion. That's what you told me, Ellis.
Her husband said nothing.
Please tell me you didn't lie about the bruises and the black eye.
Dorothy pressed.
She wanted out of the marriage,
Ellis explained.
Nathaniel was too old for Arlene. She was so young and free-spirited. She didn't want to be tied down. She was too weak to do it on her own. So I said I would help her, and that's what I did.
Dorothy paled.
From the first moment you met Nathaniel, you didn't like him.
I told Arlene not to marry him, but she didn't listen.
She could have divorced him, Ellis.
Ellis grunted. Z felt sort of bad for Dorothy, but she really just wished Ellis would put the gun down. Instead, his hands were shaking now, his finger on the trigger, the weapon pointed right at her.
Please put the gun away, Z said.
Nobody paid her any mind.
How could you do that to us?
Dorothy asked Ellis.
We've spent what should have been the best part of our lives worrying about Arlene, afraid Nathaniel would find her and finish her off for good. Why?
There was a knock on the door. Everyone froze. This was her chance.
Help!
Z shouted. The doorbell buzzed repeatedly, a grating sound that couldn't possibly be ignored. With guns still in hand, raised and pointed, Ellis exited the bedroom. Dorothy looked at Z, then quickly followed her husband out of the room.
What are you doing?
She asked him.
Don't answer the door.
Z stepped out of the closet and ran to the window. Toby was at the door. She didn't want to knock on the glass or shout and call attention to herself. She tried to open the window, but the latch wouldn't budge. The doorbell continued to buzz. Her heart was beating fast. Not sure what to do, she rushed out of the room and headed straight for the sliding door.
Stop or I'll shoot!
Z froze at the sound of Ellis's voice.
Get over here where I can see you,
he shouted. He hadn't asked Z to hold her hands in the air, but she held both arms straight above her head, just in case, as she moved slowly toward the front door. Dorothy's gaze was watery as Z walked past. Clearly distraught, the elderly woman's hands were clasped. Ellis took his eyes off Z long enough to look through the peephole.
Who is it?
Dorothy asked.
I'm not sure,
Ellis said, his voice wavering. When he glanced over his shoulder at his wife, Z noticed a sheen of sweat covering his forehead. Ellis glared at Z.
Get some duct tape from the laundry room,
he told his wife. Z didn't like the sound of that, but thankfully Dorothy didn't budge. Z ran through her options. Run for the sliding door and pray Ellis missed if he took a shot at her. Try to knock the old man over and open the door, or beg for Ellis to listen to reason. She opted for number three.
Just let me go, she pleaded.
What's going on in there?
Toby shouted from outside. Ellis turned that way, and Zee didn't hesitate to grab a decorative vase from the coffee table. She raised it over her head and was about to hit Ellis with it when Dorothy used all her weight to push Zee to the floor. Zee toppled over. The vase hit the floor and exploded into pieces. Glass scraped against her arms when she reached for Dorothy's ankle and pulled her to the ground with her. Ellis paled but stood firm, determined to stop anyone from coming or going. Toby knocked on the door and shouted for someone to let him in, prompting Ellis to turn back to the door. Zee figured this might be her last chance. If she didn't get that door open, she would be back to square one, trapped, maybe killed. She jumped to her feet, rushed toward Ellis, and pushed him out of the way so she could unlock and open the door. Ellis wrestled with her as she tried to escape. The gun went off. The blast was deafening. Ears ringing, eyes wide, Zee watched Toby clutch his arm. Blood seeped through his shirt and onto his fingers as he sank to his knees. Dorothy let out a piercing screech.
No!
Zee shouted. 52. Jesse ran across the field, following a trail of flattened weeds and grass that Brody Hoffman must have made when he dragged Lacey to the house. The path ended at the hole in the ground where the hose disappeared, just as Lacey had said. Jesse located the valve a few feet away and shut off the water. Looking down the opening, she asked,
"Is anyone down there?"
She could hear water sloshing. And then a voice, a small, squeaky voice.
"Help me,"
he said, as if he were afraid he might wake someone. She poked her head inside the vent and leaned in as far as she could.
"Help is on the way. Can you make it through the vent? If so, you might be able to use the hose to climb out of there." "Snakes," he said. "I can't move."
"There are snakes in the water?"
"Yes, there are two large black snakes swimming around."
Shit.
"Are they poisonous?"
he asked. Jesse pulled out her cell and searched the internet for large black snakes.
"Is the body of the snake slender?" "No. Thick and large. Get me out of here."
It looked to Jesse like he might be dealing with water moccasins. The snakes were deadly. The venom was toxic and would probably kill him if he was bitten.
"Do they have a blocky, triangular head?" "Yes."
"Okay." She needed to tell him the truth.
"They are dangerous," she told him, "but they are not easily provoked. Don't make any sudden moves, and whatever you do, don't try to corner the snakes." "Help me," he said, his voice quivery and hoarse. "I hear sirens," she told him. "I need to go and tell them what's going on. I'll be back." "Don't leave! Help me!"
She pushed herself to her feet and ran back to the house. 30 minutes later, emergency workers were trying to find the right people to begin the process of widening the vent area so they could reach Jason Geiger and pull him out. As medics examined Lacey, Jesse stayed at her side. The EMT had Lacey take small sips of water while they waited for news about her husband. If the emergency workers could free him, they would take both Lacey and Jason to the hospital together.
"He buried us alive,"
Lacey said, obviously trying to wrap her mind around what had happened.
"He trapped us inside a small, windowless room where he planned to watch us die."
The EMT took her blood pressure. Lacey met Jesse's gaze.
"How did you know we were missing?"
"I didn't. I had no idea where you were or if foul play was involved when I first went to your house to talk to you."
"What did you want to talk to me about?"
Jesse frowned.
"Your grandmother Laura passed away and named you in her will. I'm sorry about your loss."
A funny look crossed over Lacey's face. "Don't worry," Jesse told her. "I'm not going to tell anyone."
"Thank you."
Lacey knew what she meant. Jesse could see it in her eyes. Nobody needed to know her real identity.
"I haven't seen my grandmother in years," Lacey said. "I do remember her, though. How did you get the news?"
An attorney in charge of your grandmother's trust couldn't find you, but he had reason to believe you were in the Sacramento area, so he called me. Jesse smiled. I'm a private investigator. Nobody had seen you or Jason since you went to dinner for your anniversary. I had a limited number of days to find you.
In about 5 minutes,
the medic said to Jesse after talking to someone over his two-way radio,
we're going to have to take your friend to the hospital.
What about Jason?
Lacey asked.
Looks like it might take a while to get him out.
Jesse wrote down the name of the hospital. We'll talk later when you're feeling better. Lacey placed her hand on Jesse's arm.
How did you find us?
Jesse didn't know how Lacey felt about her husband, but she decided it was best to be up front. I made a list of Jason's enemies and went after the people he'd hurt the most. Lacey winced.
Were there many?
Jesse nodded. I had no idea who I was married to until I was trapped underground with him. I'm leaving him. It's better that you know the truth, Jesse said. After all you've been through, I hope you can find peace now.
Thank you, Lacey said. I'll be fine.
She sipped her water and licked her dry, cracked lips. Please don't leave town before we have a chance to talk again. Jesse wrote her number on a piece of paper and closed Lacey's hand around it. Lacey smiled.
I have a feeling you would find me.
Jesse watched as Lacey was carried off on a gurney. The assistant medic packed his equipment and told Jesse that Lacey had a broken leg and was dehydrated, but that the baby was doing well and the cooler weather had probably helped keep Lacey alive. The baby was doing well.
Interesting.
While crime scene technicians gathered in the house to collect and analyze evidence, Jesse made her way to the backyard, where the detective was sitting on a lawn chair, waiting to get her account of what happened. It was getting dark by the time the detective finished writing his report. He told her she was free to go, but Jesse asked for permission to see Brody Hoffman's bedroom. She wasn't allowed through the door, but she could see inside. Notes and drawings covered every wall. Some of the drawings resembled the artwork of a 5-year-old. She listened as the detective talked to technicians about the notebooks. Apparently, Brody Hoffman had wanted to play cat and mouse with Jason while he watched from his computer screen. The red ants and venomous snakes were only the beginning. He'd written a lot about being smarter than Jason Geiger. Certain Jason would die a slow, agonizing death. Jesse wondered if, at any point, Brody had realized what he'd done by bringing Lacey along for the ride. The detective had already determined that it took a special kind of person to carry out a plan like this without detection. Brody Hoffman's obsession, meticulous planning, and most likely psychopathic personality had enabled him to bring his plan to fruition. Nothing more to see there, she decided. Hearing about Brody's obsession with Jason and seeing his irrational thoughts put to paper made her sad. Instead of making her way to the front of the house and heading home, she returned to the backyard. She wanted to wait and see if Jason Geiger got out safely. As she stepped outside, she thought of the metal cuffs and the hardships Lacey had survived at a young age. Now older, wiser, pregnant, and off to celebrate 8 years of marriage, Lacey had been buried alive with a man she'd thought she could trust to be there for her. Jesse shook her head at the thought of there being so much wickedness in the world. Without war, disease, suffering, and death, would the good, love, laughter, health, not be as meaningful? Did it take the depravity of humankind for people to appreciate everything else? Exhaustion threatened to weigh her down as it suddenly dawned on her that she hadn't had a chance to tell Lacey how much her grandmother had left her. Lacey hadn't even asked. It could wait another day or two. Her phone buzzed. It was Z. Jesse hadn't seen her in days. She picked up the call and said hello.
Are you in your office? Z asked, her tone sharp.
No, I'm in Elk Grove. You sound agitated. Is everything okay?
Nothing is okay. Ellis Cash shot Toby.
Jesse felt as if she'd been punched in the gut. Why would Ellis Cash shoot a young boy?
I don't understand. Did he kill him?
No, Toby is alive, but I'll get to that in a minute. It all started when Ellis Cash pointed a gun at me and
He had a gun pointed at you when you were doing surveillance?
No, actually, when I was hiding in their closet. I sneezed and blew my cover, no pun intended.
Jessie closed her eyes and pinched the bridge of her nose. Please don't tell me you broke into their house when they were out.
I broke into their house when they were out.
Jessie took a deep breath.
Don't worry, the bullet just grazed Toby's arm. He's okay now. But after he was shot, he passed out. I gave him mouth to mouth, which turned out to be completely unnecessary. While I was trying to save Toby's life, Dorothy was yelling at Ellis for lying to her all these years. She was so angry, I thought for sure she was going to have a heart attack.
What did Ellis lie about?
Oh, I didn't tell you that part?
No, you didn't.
Arlene Snyder, Penny's mother, is alive.
Jessie took in the news slowly.
Are you sure?
Yes. She's married and has two kids and is living in New England.
So what did Ellis lie about?
Listen carefully, Z said, prompting Jessie to roll her eyes. They both knew that their daughter was alive, and as you know, it was their testimony that put Nathaniel Snyder, Penny's father, in prison all those years ago. But it was Ellis Cash who told his wife, Dorothy, that Nathaniel was beating Arlene.
But he wasn't? Jessie asked.
No, he wasn't. I met him. The guy wouldn't hurt a flea.
Why would Ellis lie in the courtroom under oath?
Because he wanted his daughter to be free to start her life over. His words, not mine. He thought Nathaniel was much too old for Arlene. And he thought she was too sweet or maybe too weak-minded to ever leave him. So he and his daughter made a plan.
Jessie's jaw hardened.
Didn't he stop to think about how all of this would affect Penny?
I think that was a big part of his plan, to take Penny in and raise her as their own.
Jessie heard muffled voices.
I'll be right there, Z said. I've got to go. Toby is milking this for all it's worth.
Does Penny know what's going on?
You bet. I called her right after I realized Toby was going to make it. She came over to the house. You should have been there. It was utter and complete pandemonium.
There was no goodbye before the call was disconnected. Jessie shook her head, then looked up when she heard the emergency crew clap and cheer. A few minutes later, Jason was on a gurney, being carried to the ambulance waiting out front.
Is he going to be okay?
Jessie asked the EMT.
Unlike the woman, he's showing no signs of dehydration. Healthy as an ox. But we'll let the doctors examine him just in case.
Jessie made the walk across the field one more time so that she could take a look inside the hole. Bright fluorescent lights had been set up around the perimeter, making it easy to see things clearly. The box where Lacey and Jason had been buried, and the small, cramped quarters where they had been stuck for days, was half covered with water. The idea of finding a way out after being buried alive, only to realize you were trapped in a small, dark hole, made her shiver. One thing was certain. Anne Elizabeth Corrigan was a survivor. 53. Penny Snyder stood motionless, closed her eyes, and breathed in the fresh, earthy smell of the river behind the house she was facing. A long moment passed before she opened her eyes again. The house in Maine was a charming Cape Cod-style home with a farmer's porch wrapped around the front. Even from the sidewalk, it was easy to see that the oversized windows provided lots of light. The fence surrounding the yard wasn't tall enough to hide views of the river. The idea of possibly seeing her mother after all these years did not make Penny nervous. The truth was, she didn't know how she felt. There were too many emotions running through her to pick just one or two. 2 weeks ago, she might have been ecstatic at finding her mother alive and well. But this woman, whom she'd thought about every single day without fail for the past 30 years, had abandoned her. This woman had allowed Penny's father, an innocent man whom Penny had come to love despite her distrust of him, to spend 10 years of his life in prison. Abandoning her daughter was one thing, but allowing an innocent man to go to prison was quite another. It was Friday. She'd given Dorothy and Ellis no choice but to answer all her questions in detail, threatening to go to the police if they didn't talk. And when she ran out of things to ask them, she said goodbye. She didn't want anything to do with Dorothy or Ellis Cash. If they came anywhere near her, she told them, she would get a restraining order. She refused to listen to Dorothy's assurance that she knew nothing about Ellis and Arlene's plans. Penny didn't care about either one of them. They were evil, spiteful people who didn't deserve her love. Dorothy told Penny that her mother had remarried. Arlene's husband, Bob, was a banker. Arlene and Bob had twin 15-year-old girls. Penny also learned that Arlene worked at the school the girls attended, but took Fridays off to paint or do whatever might strike her fancy, as Dorothy had so fondly put it. No, Penny decided. She wasn't nervous. She was livid. She pressed the ringer.
Who is it?
A female voice asked from within. Penny Snyder, your daughter. The door opened. The woman was tall and blonde, with hardly any worry lines to mark her 59 years. Penny's breath caught in her throat. She felt as if she were looking into a mirror. Her first inclination was to fall into her mother's arms, hold her close, and breathe her in, something she'd dreamed of doing for so long. But the flat look in Arlene's eyes stopped her.
Are you going to invite me inside?
It was obvious that Arlene had been alerted to the possibility that she might get a visit from Penny. It took Arlene a moment to respond to her question.
Yes, of course, she finally said.
Penny stepped inside. Arlene left the door open as Penny walked toward the kitchen, which was wide open and lit up by the sunlight pouring through the windows. The home reminded her of Dorothy's house. How many times, she wondered, had Ellis and Dorothy visited their daughter? How many barbecues and family gatherings had they enjoyed without Penny?
What do you want? Arlene asked.
A deep ache settled in her heart as Penny turned to face Arlene, her mother, the woman she'd thought about nearly every day of her life, and said,
Absolutely nothing. Then why are you here?
I wanted to give you this. Penny handed her the aged and sagging cardboard box, the one filled with letters and pictures that her father had collected and saved for all these years.
You can burn the box along with its contents, but I want you to know that I scanned every single memento of your time with Dad. I never should have left you with him.
Penny looked into her mother's eyes. Arlene's tone wasn't sad or regretful. It was unemotional. Penny's vision blurred, and she wiped at her eyes, then adamantly began to shake her head.
I'm glad you left me with Dad. If you had an ounce of morality or compassion or any of those normal human feelings, you would have left Dad and me without resorting to lies and using your weakness to get your father to do your dirty work. I feel sorry for your children.
Arlene's face reddened.
I think you should leave. And take this with you.
Penny stiffened. I have been here for 2 minutes and you're already sending me away? There was no response as they stared one another down.
Do you have any idea how many nights I cried for you after you were gone?
Penny asked.
For years, I hated Dad for something he didn't do.
A tear slid down her cheek.
I loved you. Dad loved you. What sort of person allows another to go to prison for something he didn't do?
Arlene raised her chin a notch. The blank look on her face failed to hide the fact that she was nervous. The subtle facial tics gave her away. Penny wiped her cheek.
Did you ever once think about me? Wonder what sort of person I had become? Of course.
Silence hovered between them, hot and heavy, as Penny waited, hoping for more. It was difficult for her to imagine what sort of person could do what Arlene had done. But it was clear that Arlene had moved on and had never looked back.
I wanted you to have those letters and mementos and tell you that I'm going to write a book.
Arlene exhaled.
I'm going to tell the world the truth. If you try to stop me,
I will hire the best lawyers, and I will do everything in my power to make sure your parents go to jail for lying under oath.
It's time for you to go, Arlene said flatly.
Penny walked to the door and rested her hand on the handle as she looked over her shoulder at Arlene. In 3 years, on your twin daughter's 18th birthdays, I will be returning here to tell my half-sisters everything I know about their mother. I think they deserve to know the person who has raised them, don't you? Jessie sat in the front row, listening to Penny talk about her father. Zee sat to her right. The funeral for Nathaniel Snyder was taking place outdoors in the chill of a February afternoon. The burial service was small, with no more than 15 people in attendance. Nathaniel Snyder had passed away a week after Penny saw her mother for the first time in 30 years. It was a sad, sad story. Arlene could have divorced her husband, but instead had allowed her father to make elaborate plans that included sending Nathaniel to prison. After her visit to Maine, Penny had stopped by the office to let Jessie and Zee know that her father had passed away. She'd been at her father's side when he took his last breath. Although he couldn't respond, she told Dad she'd found Arlene and that she knew he was innocent. She held his hand and made sure he knew how much she loved him, letting him know he was the best father a girl could ask for. Nathaniel Snyder would not be forgotten. Standing at the podium, Penny spoke about all the great memories she'd shared with her father. How they nearly burned the house down when he taught her to cook. How he would try to impress her friends by standing on his head. And how he spent long hours taking videos when she played sports so he could watch the games again at home.
He taught me how to use power tools, Penny said, smiling. And how to climb onto the roof, change a tire, and install a new electrical outlet. All in one afternoon,
Zee chuckled.
My dad taught me to always wait until the morning to solve a problem.
Penny used a tissue to wipe her eyes.
Mostly, my dad, Nathaniel James Snyder, taught me that real love makes you strong and gives you courage and is always, absolutely, without a doubt, unconditional.
Jessie felt a tightening in her chest. She was proud of Zee for solving her first case. She was also happy for Penny. She would finally have closure and hopefully some newfound peace. There would be no reception after the ceremony. As Jessie and Zee waited their turn to talk to Penny, Zee gestured to her right. See that dark sedan down the road? The one parked behind the white Camry? Jessie glanced that way.
Looks like someone is inside. Do you know who it is?
I think it's Dorothy.
Why would she come here? Do you really think she was gullible enough to believe everything her husband said about Nathaniel abusing their daughter?
Definitely, Zee said. I did a tarot reading to confirm.
Jessie smiled.
I did a good job on my first case, didn't I?
Zee asked. You broke into another house, Jessie reprimanded.
That's two in less than 6 months. So I guess that means I won't be getting a raise?
You can't just break into people's homes whenever you want, Zee. Your actions are jeopardizing everything I've worked so hard for.
Breaking and entering worked both times. But I'm sorry, I won't do it again.
How am I going to trust you moving forward?
I'll never break into another house for as long as I live. I swear on my mother's grave.
I'll give you one more chance, Zee, but that's it. I won't have any choice but to let you go if it happens again.
Zee opened her mouth, but then shut it after Jessie said, No raise.
Zee sighed.
Wanna see a cool shirt I found online?
Sure.
It was difficult to stay mad at the girl.
Zee held open her jacket so Jessie could see it, whether or not she wanted to. The shirt was black with bold lettering and read, Listen to the voices in your head.
Pretty cool, right?
Are the voices referring to Marion, Lucy, and Francis?
Duh.
Jessie smiled. Do you listen to them?
Do I have a choice?
They shared a laugh. Zee zipped her jacket closed.
I've finally come to terms with the voices. They make me laugh and keep me from getting lonely. Jesse nodded.
How's Toby?
He's a little dramatic. Pretends like he can't use his arm. It's a little annoying, but he did ask me if I wanted to help him find an apartment and move in with him.
Wow, that was fast. How do you feel about that?
I'm really not sure. I think it's too soon. I want him to work a little harder at this relationship, sort of like you and Colin.
What do you mean?
Are you kidding me? Z asked. Look how hard he has to work it just to get you to look at the house he wants to share with you, Olivia, and Piper.
What are you talking about? Z's eyes widened.
Nothing. I didn't say a word. Except that it has a huge backyard and lots of windows. She zipped her lips closed. Jesse wondered if it were true. Did Colin want to move in together? Coming home to Colin and the girls every night made her heart race in a good way. She and Colin knew each other's habits, good and bad. They respected and trusted each other. It could work. Before she could try to get more details out of Z, Penny joined them.
Thank you for coming, she said.
Sorry for your loss, Jesse told her. He was a cool dude, Z added. You were lucky to have him in your life. Penny smiled.
Thank you both for everything.
Do you think you'll ever see your mom again? Z asked.
I don't think so, Penny said.
You were right about Arlene being alive, Z said, her tone reflective as if she didn't expect a response.
Yes, I was, Penny said. But I definitely didn't think it all through.
I knew my grandfather didn't like my dad, but I had no idea his hatred for him ran so deep. The three of them started walking toward the parking lot. Penny looked over her shoulder, blew a kiss toward the casket, and said,
Goodbye, Dad.
If she'd been looking ahead, she would have seen Z wave to the woman in the dark sedan before the car sped off. 54. That evening, as Jesse was setting the table, she heard a knock at the door.
Come in!
Higgins barked until he saw Colin appear at the top of the stairs. The dog sniffed his hand and then began the dance of happiness. The man who had carried him off the street after a hit and run and taken him to the vet was here. Jesse laughed as she tried to squeeze her way between them so she could get a proper greeting from the man she'd come to realize meant everything to her. Colin understood her. He challenged her and listened to her. Her life was better with him in it.
Wow,
Colin said as she squeezed him tight.
Why do I get the feeling you've missed me?
Because I have. She gestured toward the kitchen. I made lasagna.
You do love me,
he said, smiling.
Where's Olivia?
She'll be back soon. She's doing some filing at the office. Jesse looked him over. You look exhausted.
I'm tired, I'm not going to lie.
The Willis case?
Yeah. I thought I had our man, but I was wrong.
Who?
Peyton White, the father of the girl who was sitting next to the coach at the movie theater.
Oh.
The man lied about his alibi, so we got a search warrant. I found a certain bloom in the backyard. White, vibrant. Mexican orange, it's called.
He shook his head.
We also found rope that looked similar to the rope used to hang Willis.
But, Jesse prodded.
It wasn't a match. Just got the call a few minutes ago.
I'm sorry.
I'm not giving up. I don't want this to end up being just another unsolved homicide to add to the growing pile.
This case has really gotten to you, hasn't it? He said nothing. There's something else, isn't there?
It's nothing.
No, tell me.
In two words, Ben Morrison.
Without Ben, she was certain she never would have found her sister, and she and Olivia would still be unable to move forward with their lives. Ben had been a positive force in her life, and it frustrated her that he couldn't see that. Why does it always come full circle back to Ben? Colin exhaled.
Don't you think it's odd how comfortable Morrison is around homicide scenes?
You're comfortable, aren't you?
Not like that. I go home, I eat dinner, and then I try to go to sleep. But sleep doesn't come. Instead, I toss and turn because all I can see is the face of the victim, Some of these crime scenes are unthinkable displays of a monster's whim. Psychopaths who show no mercy. Blood and crushed bones. But Morrison never flinches. It's as if he has nerves of steel, or maybe no nerves at all.
You don't know whether he sleeps at night, Jesse told him.
True.
Colin chuckled. What?
The truth is, he'd probably make a good homicide detective. I've been reading the cases he's written about over the past few decades. Do you know how many times he's managed to show up before the police?
No. How many?
At least a dozen times. I couldn't find one other crime reporter who was able to beat the cops one time, let alone 12.
Jesse went back to setting the table.
Everywhere I go, Morrison seems to appear out of the blue. I still haven't forgotten the guilty look on his face when I pulled him over for a broken taillight. He got out of the car and was walking to the back of his van as if to show me something.
What are you trying to say?
I think he was going to make a confession. Show me what he had back there. If I hadn't stopped it, told him it was just a broken taillight, I would have found out.
But you didn't, Jesse said. You've had a long day. You're tired. And I think your bias against Ben Morrison is rearing its ugly head again. He wrapped an arm around her waist and pulled her close.
Maybe you're right.
She smiled. Did you bring the car?
I did. It's parked across the street.
Is there something else you want to talk to me about? Jesse asked. He frowned. Z told me about the house you found.
How would Z know?
She heard it through the grapevine. Piper told Olivia, and Olivia told Z. It's pretty simple the way that works.
I don't think I thought this through,
Colin said. So it's true?
Are you interested?
She stepped back from his embrace and looked around the house. So much laughter, so many tears shed under this roof. She knew every creak in the floor, every scratch, every flaw. How many times had she come through the door, grateful to be home? Looking at Colin, she met his gaze and smiled, thinking about living together and breathing life into a new place. I think it's time to make new memories. You and me and the girls. Together. He wrapped his arms around her, his laughter cut off with a kiss as she melted into his arms. Get a room, Olivia said as she walked in. Jesse pulled away from Colin. Why do you always tiptoe up the stairs? So I can catch you guys making out like a couple of high school kids. Jesse felt heat rise to her face. Colin took a seat on the couch. Olivia wagged a finger at Colin. I think it's time for you, young man, to go home. She pointed to the stairs leading to the door. Colin smirked.
What would you say if I told you I think I could change your mind about sending me away?
Jesse headed for the kitchen, leaving them to tease each other. She grabbed the pot holders from the drawer and pulled the lasagna from the oven. Her stomach growled. Olivia snorted. I would say you've been drinking. Colin lifted his hands as if to show her he was clean.
No beer or wine in hand.
You two have fun, Olivia said as she started off toward her bedroom. Both Jesse and Olivia turned toward Colin when they heard keys jangling. Now? Jesse asked Colin. She knew he had a surprise for Olivia, but she'd assumed he was going to wait until after dinner. The thought that maybe the anticipation was too much for him caused a warm, fuzzy feeling to radiate through her chest. Olivia brightened. I can drive your car?
No,
Colin said.
It's better than that. I found a car, with Jesse's permission, of course. A great deal. It's used, but the engine is clean, and it has low mileage, and it's all yours.
Olivia looked at Jesse. Is he serious? Jesse nodded. Moments like this, knowing how close the two of them had gotten over the years, was exactly the type of thing that made life good. Olivia respected Colin, maybe even loved him. He was a good man, and she felt grateful to have him in her life. Are you serious? Olivia asked Colin. He jangled the keys again.
I have never been more serious. It's all yours, kiddo.
Olivia screamed. Higgins barked.
and they all ran outside together to see the new member of the Cole family, a 2010 Ford Fusion. Colin told them to climb in, even Higgins, and they drove a few miles away to their new house. It was perfect. That night, hours after Olivia fell asleep in her room and Colin left to get some much-needed sleep, Jesse lay in bed staring up at the ceiling. Remnants of their happy night prompted her to think of Sophie. She usually thought of her sister at times like this. Olivia was getting older, and it was events such as this when Jesse wished Sophie could be here. She grabbed her Kindle from the bedside table, read a couple of pages, and then gave up and put the device back on the table. Instead, she thought of Ben. Colin was a good man, and he had good instincts. He was an amazing detective. What evil signs did he see in Ben Morrison that she didn't? It was sort of ironic, Jesse thought, that Colin had brought him up tonight, since Jesse had only today called and left Ben a message just to say hello. She liked Ben Morrison. He was a big part of her life, and yet she hadn't seen him since he and his family were over for a holiday feast. More important, she'd never talked to Ben and told him what she'd heard about the death of Allie Shear, the woman found buried in the backyard of Ben's childhood home in Clarksburg. Ben's father was found guilty for her murder, and yet Jesse had talked to a woman who said she saw Ben strangle the young woman to death. Why hadn't she mentioned the news to Ben? Was it because the woman was an alcoholic and not a credible witness? Was it because his father was dead and telling him wouldn't change anything? Or was it because Ben had not only saved her life, but also Olivia's? Like Colin, Jesse had put a lot of thought into how and why Ben Morrison seemed to show up at the most opportune of times. Not too many people would deny that there was something off about Ben Morrison. Jesse usually ended up blaming his amnesia for any oddities in his personality. Would she ever know why he was with her sister on the night of his tragic car accident? Or whether or not he was responsible for the death of Allie Shear? The answer came to her then. She didn't need to know. It was that simple. Her sister, Sophie, was never coming back. Friends and family had gathered at the memorial service to say goodbye. Jesse and Olivia had spent a decade mourning Sophie's absence. They had closure now. The truth of what happened the night Sophie disappeared was buried deep within the recesses of Ben Morrison's mind. Before falling asleep, Jesse envisioned living with Colin, Olivia, and Piper in the house Colin had found. It wasn't the house she was excited about, but the family she and Colin would be building. The four of them would be a strong family unit, giving each other emotional security. They would all be there for one another, supporting each other during the inevitable ups and downs life had to offer. It was a loving family that made a perfect home. With that thought at the forefront of her mind, a feeling of weightlessness overcame her as she reached over and turned off the lamp. 55. 1 week later. After Melanie and the kids left to do some shopping, Ben decided that now would be a good time to take a look at his van. It had been making a strange, rattling sound. He flipped on the light switch in the garage, then pushed the button. The garage door rolled open, giving him light. The first thing he did was check the air pressure in all four tires. Then he made sure there weren't any loose lug nuts. Worn mounts wouldn't hold the engine or transmission tight against the frame, and that could lead to vibrations or possibly a rattling sound. Next, he went in search of his trusty mechanic's creeper with rollers. He'd been diagnosing and repairing problems with his van for as long as he could remember. He found the creeper in one of the garage cabinets, unfolded it, then got down on all fours and lay down on top of it, face up. He grabbed a few tools and a flashlight and pushed himself under the chassis. With the flashlight in one hand, he used his other to examine the undercarriage and see if anything might be loose. As he searched, he reached up, his fingers feeling around in an area near the suspension,
a spot that he couldn't quite see into, even with his flashlight. Something rattled. He moved around a bit, using the light to try and see what he was dealing with. Again, he felt around. This time, he was able to determine that 6-inch metal hooks were holding the object in place. If he lifted the hook high enough, he determined that he might be able to unfasten it from the chassis. It wasn't until he'd removed 6 hooks total that he was able to slide the object to a spot where he could see that it was a metal box about the size of a small paperback novel. It took some doing, but he wasn't one to give up easily, and after 15 minutes of pushing and pulling, he was able to turn the box just so and slide it out of its hiding place. Whatever was inside clinked against the metal interior. It wasn't very heavy. He chuckled at the idea that he might have found a long-lost treasure, valuables once hidden by whoever had owned the van before him. He set the box on his stomach and then rolled out from under the vehicle. It wasn't until he was back on his feet and holding the box in front of him that he saw that there was a lock on it. A miniature padlock, like the kind that kept a diary safe from prying eyes. Since he didn't have a key, he took the box to his work area and grabbed a hammer. Before he could break the lock off, somebody said his name. Turning toward the driveway, he was surprised to see Colin Grayson. He knew the detective was just doing his job, but at the same time, he sensed something more. Colin didn't like him, never had. Ben set the hammer down and walked toward him.
"Go ahead,"
Ben said.
"Search my house. Search the backyard, the garage, my underwear drawers. I give up. Just get it over with."
Ben walked to the kitchen door and held it open for him.
"I deserve that. Thanks for the offer, but I'll stay right where I am, thanks."
Ben headed back his way, wiped greasy hands on his already dirty jeans.
"Melanie would never forgive me if I wasn't a good host. Can I get you water? Hot tea?"
Colin rolled his eyes.
"I came here to apologize." "Why would you do that?"
Ben asked.
"As you've reminded me on more than one occasion, you were just doing your job. We're all just doing our jobs. And besides,"
Ben added,
"I'm sure Jesse put you up to this. Love can make us do crazy things." "She's not the reason I'm here."
Ben remained silent. He had nothing left to say.
"I haven't given you a fair shake, and I'm sorry for that."
Colin gestured toward the house.
"I take it Melanie isn't home since you invited me inside? She and the kids went shopping. Tell her I'm sorry for causing her undue stress, will you?"
Ben nodded, still not sure what to make of Grayson's visit. With nothing left to say, Ben watched Grayson pivot on his feet and make his way back to his car. He opened the car door and then sort of froze, staring at Ben's next-door neighbor's house or front yard. He couldn't be sure. It seemed like an interminably long time to stare into the horizon. But finally, he slipped in behind the wheel of his car and drove off. Ben walked to where Grayson had been staring, trying to figure out what he might have been looking at. The only thing that stood out were the magnificent little white flowers that had bloomed on the shrubs in front of their house. Scratching the side of his neck, he went back to where he'd left the box. One smack of the hammer busted the lock right off. The lid was rusty, and he had to put a little muscle into it to get it off. At first, he wasn't sure what he was looking at. He turned the box over, dumping its contents onto his work table. He picked up one of the cards, but it wasn't a card at all. It was a driver's license. A woman named June Emerson. She didn't look familiar. Unable to comprehend what he was seeing, he focused on a pair of earrings, sterling silver wrapped around blue stones. He scooped up the gold necklace and let it dangle between his fingers before setting it back on the table. There was also a ring with a tiny circle of diamonds. He picked up a different ID, and when he saw her picture, a wave of dizziness washed over him. Allie Shear. Female, green eyes, blonde hair. Her address in Clarksburg, California. His stomach knotted. He turned over all the IDs, placing them in a row so that he could see names and faces. DJ Stum, Ali Shear, June Emerson, John Eberling. For a split second, he stopped breathing. Feeling numb, he shoved everything back into the box and went inside the house. He took the stairs two at a time. Inside his bedroom, he grabbed his laptop and turned it on. After a moment, he searched the internet for June Emerson. The same woman on the driver's license popped right up. June Emerson, a daycare worker who had fatally tortured an infant and harmed dozens of children in her care. Police found her inside her apartment with a plastic bag over her head and a rope tied tight around her neck. He shut his computer. Dazed, he stood up and went to the closet, where he reached into the pocket of a jacket he seldom wore. There was a hole. He dug around inside the lining until he found what he was looking for. Another driver's license. This one belonged to Roger Willis. Ben's heart was beating fast, making it difficult to breathe. Although he couldn't recall how or when, he knew he'd killed them all. Ali Shear, DJ Stum, June Emerson, John Eberling, Roger Willis, maybe others. Strangling the heartless killer had been a different story. He'd killed the man in self-defense. Or had he? He could still remember the rush of euphoria he'd experienced when he'd wrapped his hands around the serial killer's neck. And what about Roger Willis? Roger Willis wasn't a serial killer, nor was he someone from Ben's past. It wasn't until Ben confronted him early Sunday morning and found him clutching a one-way ticket to Miami that he'd realized Willis had planned to simultaneously escape the country and justice. Once Willis left the state, the odds would have been against a warrant being entered into the NCIC. Local law enforcement wouldn't have had the funds to pay the cost or jump through the legal hoops required for Willis to be extradited. In that moment, Ben had known what needed to be done. But there was more to it than that. Hadn't he been feeling an underlying urge to take the man's life? To kill again? DJ Stum had killed his family. June Emerson had killed an infant and tortured children. John Eberling had stolen from his mother and killed her beloved pet. Had he killed those people in his own selfish pursuit of justice? If so, why Ali Shear? As far as he knew, she'd done nothing more than break his heart. He looked down at his hands, curled and uncurled his fingers. Were these the hands of a killer? In a state of shock, he made his way back down the stairs. A framed photo hanging on the wall caught his attention. He stopped to look at the recent family picture Melanie had enlarged, then framed and hung with the others. His gaze roamed lovingly over his wife and kids, his beautiful family. His chest tightened. He took a breath as he realized his sister had known who and what he was all along. His father, too. His legs wobbled. He sat on the step behind him, let his head fall into the palms of his hands, and let it all out. Emotions weaved tightly together like a ball of yarn. He cried tears of anguish, regret, and shame. It was a while before he made his way back into the garage. He added Roger Willis's ID to the others in the box. Sophie Cole's ID was not among the others, which was a relief. She had been driving the car the night of the accident that left him with amnesia. He might never know what their plans had been that night, and now, suddenly, he was glad for it. He and Jesse Cole had become friends in the truest sense, and he hoped to keep it that way. He set about gathering the tools he would need to reattach the metal case to the undercarriage and got to work. When he was finished, and his dark secret was well hidden and no longer loose, he rolled out from under the van. For now, until he had time to give the situation further consideration, he would leave things be.
Destroying the contents of the case would be a wise choice, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. He was still cleaning up and putting away his tools when Melanie and the kids pulled into the driveway. Abigail and Sean jumped out of the car and said hello as they ran past him into the house. Melanie smiled at Ben as she approached. She wrapped her arms around his waist and leaned her head against his chest.
"I'm dirty,"
he warned.
"I don't care. I'm just glad this whole Roger Willis business is finally over and that you're home where you belong and everything is back to normal."
She pulled back so she could look up at him.
"Are you okay?"
"Never been better."
She gave him a quizzical look.
"I've finally come to terms with my past,"
he explained.
"I'm done searching. I'm ready to let it all go."
She rested a hand on her chest over her heart.
"This makes me so happy. I've been worried about you for a while now."
"No more worrying, okay? Things are going to change around here. Ben is back."
She laughed.
"I'm going to go get dinner started. I'll make spaghetti and then we'll celebrate with a glass of wine."
She got to the door leading to the house and then stopped and gestured toward the van.
"Did you find the problem?"
"I did. No more rattle,"
he said proudly.
"It's all fixed and good as new."
"Just like you,"
she said with a smile before disappearing inside.
"Yeah,"
he said to no one.
"Just like me."
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Buried Deep by T.R. Reagan, performed by Kate Rudd, engineered by Stephen Jacoby. Performance copyright 2019 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.